The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached by calling 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return to the December 2018 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month, of course, is Christmas in Carolina. And if you'll pardon the occasional clearing of the throat with this upper respiratory thing going around, we'll get going. Life of the Party. In North Carolina, the holiday season doesn't really get rolling until the sausage balls arrive. Yet even here, the origin of the recipe remains a mystery. In college, my freshman roommate regularly received an overnight package from her stepmother that contained a few dozen sausage balls and a note about how best to freeze and reheat them. No matter the month, their arrival always conjured Christmas morning. She would cut open the box, then dart down to the dorm's shared kitchen to reheat the oven. And it wasn't long before we were enjoying a snack beloved by both of our families. Mine in North Carolina, hers in Tennessee. Sausage balls are extremely simple to make. A mere combination of country sausage, shredded cheese, and pre-made biscuit mix that's baked until lightly browned. They're also extremely popular in North Carolina. As Kenneth Edwards, president of Bass Farm Sausage in Spring Hope, observes, I don't believe they could be more popular anywhere else. It's impossible, really. Especially around Christmas, the appetizer is a staple across the state in cooler months, served at parties and given as gifts. It's no coincidence that, in a southern drawl, sausage balls rhymes with Santa Claus. But what my college days revealed is also true. Sausage balls show up all over and well beyond North Carolina and Tennessee. A letter to the Maine Farmer and Journal of Useful Arts reveals something of a precursor in 1835. Tired of the time and effort it took to stuff sausage into cleaned pig intestines, an anonymous cook submitted a note under the heading Sausage Balls, saying that they'd rolled a little of their leftover ground meat in flour and formed it into rounds. When used, I found the balls every way as palatable and good as the meat put into skins, this clever person wrote. The exact origin of today's version isn't quite clear, though a headline in a 1987 edition of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is comically intriguing. Source of sausage ball recipe? Only hairdresser knows for sure. Similar to the Cajun sausage mixture Bodin, pork and rice sausage are fried in bites and sausage balls were likely the invention of enterprising cooks who wanted a way to stretch their food further. As Kingston's Vivian Howard notes in her cookbook, Deep Run Roots, most sausage balls are made with a little cheese and a little sausage bound by a whole lot of bisquick. What those measurements mean is that the sausage balls are inherently cheap, a pound of meat can yield up to 100 snacks, and are easy to make. Though any old flour and a bit of baking powder will do, this dish's popularity was spurred on by the convenience of bisquick. Some cooks even posit that the sausage ball's origins are linked to a marketing ploy by that product, which was introduced to grocery shelves in 1931. The brand's archivist is unable to find such proof. Still, none of that quite explains why sausage balls are so prevalent in North Carolina. To find out, you have to start at square one. The starting point is more of a rectangle, really, or, as Tommy Neese calls it, a brick. Neese is president of Neese's Country Sausage, a Greensboro-based company that pats out one-pound blocks of pork, each one carefully wrapped in butcher's wax paper that's stamped with the Neese's name and an image of a stumpy blue hog. According to Neese, this is the way his family has done business for more than a century. His great-grandfather, James Theodore, Mr. Theed, Neese fashioned his spiced sausage into one-pound bricks for delivery by covered wagons so it doesn't roll out of the truck or roll off the shelf, Neese says, laughing. Neese's sausage-making process, allowing the hog's temperature to slowly cool down after it's slaughtered, harkens back to traditional hog killings that were once common on small family farms across North Carolina in colder months, when there was a less worry about spoilage or insects. A hog was killed one day and made into sausage the next. But, as Kenneth Edwards of Bass Farm Sausage explains, it's not a process that's possible on a grand scale. Giant pork processors don't allow the hogs to cool naturally, so their production process is completed more rapidly. The result is soft, fresh meat that's squeezed into tubular packaging. People now that make a lot of volume sausage, they couldn't put it in a package like ours, Edwards says. Bass Farms also hand-packs their sausage into bricks wrapped in white wax paper, as does Coraher Frank C. Beef and Sausage in China Grove. Right now in the state, there's only three of us left that make it in that form, Neese says. There were a lot more of us at one time than there are now. A family of farmers, blacksmiths, and horse traders, the Neeses were largely self-sufficient when they settled in what's now Guilford County in 1769. They farmed what they needed, and, like many small farmers, they slaughtered the state's abundant hogs, grinding cuts into sausage, which they flavored with a mix of sage, salt, pepper, and other spices. But in 1917, the Neeses set themselves apart from the average operation. J.T. Neese began selling the family's blend, meeting the growing demand of North Carolinians who'd moved off of the family farm to work industrial jobs, such as those in the local textile mills. He just decided at one time that he saw a future in this, Neese explains. He says, "Well, instead of being a trader and a barterer, I can make a living selling sausage." So he did that. As the state and the South industrialized, other families followed suit, forming companies that sold traditional foods and, just as marketable, convenience. In addition to hawking his own country sausage, for instance, founder Ralph Bass of Bass Farm Sausage, launched in 1956 as Tri-Co Packers because it served three counties, offered custom renderings. "There are a lot of hogs in this country," Edwards says, an understatement for the eastern part of this state. "Customers would bring them in, and we'd slaughter the hogs and make sausage for them. But the market eventually waned as fewer folks kept their own pigs. So the Basses turned their focus solely to their own sausage, along with chitterlings and souse." Word spread, and folks outside the initial three counties, Edgecombe, Wilson, and Nash, caught on, purchasing block upon block of Bass's country sausage. For many, the country sausage tasted familiar. It was the stuff of home, as the first Tri-Co one-pound block advertised on the back, "Made like grandma's." That's the thing about sausage balls, too. They are a small taste of home. You still have a lot of people in North Carolina that are from North Carolina and are familiar with our product and grew up eating it, Neese says. Sausage balls have a firm foundation in the state, built brick by brick by our country sausage makers. Flip through the community cookbook, and the ingredient list for sausage balls often calls for sausage by name, Bass, Neese, or Coraher. To locals around Spring Hope, though, the name is also Edwards. Anytime Kenneth Edwards is invited to a party, the president of Bass Farm Sausage is expected to have a particular dish in tow. It's just one of those things, he says. If I go anywhere, they say, I know you brought the sausage balls. Edward's son, Brent, who serves as vice president of the company, echoes a similar sentiment. The people know we work here, he says. Make sure you guys bring the sausage balls, he says, laughing, every event. Requests are especially common around December, a cooler month that recalls the timing of traditional cog killing and sausage making in the state, a time of exchanging gifts and food, including sausage. It's a big thing at Christmas, Edward says. It's just, like, unbelievable. Stores that normally sell 5 boxes of sausage, they sell 10 boxes. It's the same for the nieces, who also see an uptick in sales around the holidays. But that's not to say it's the only reason for sausage balls. As niece puts it, I eat them every day, all day round. And that was written by Emily Wallace. And now, finding the light. Hanukkah has become a ho-hum holiday for an Asheville professor until a gathering of friends and a batch of crisp latkes, awakening his spirit. When I was a kid and when my kids were growing up, I liked Hanukkah well enough. The colored candles were pretty. The presents were memorable. The latkes were okay, but the holiday didn't have much spiritual juice for me. So when I arrived home from work last year for the fourth night of Hanukkah, I wasn't especially excited. Then I saw my wife, Lori, at the stove in her favorite apron, the Star of David spangled, grease-splattered one she wears only for one special day of the 8-day celebration, and I knew it's latke night. It's not just the apron that gives it away. It's how the house smells. Like a Chinese restaurant, Lori says. Lori loves making latkes. Although latkes aren't my favorite food, and even though Hanukkah is one of the least resonant Jewish holidays of the year for me, I love coming home to latke night. Lori spends the better part of the afternoon cleaning, grating, and draining the potatoes and forming the little discs by hand. The kitchen fills with the thick smell of potatoes frying in canola oil. This year, our latke night was a Friday night, which meant it was also Shabbat. For decades now, we've had a Friday night tradition of bringing in Shabbat with the same group of friends. To help us transition from work, week, mind to Shabbat spirit before the traditional rituals, candles, blessing of the children, kiddush, sanctification of the wine, and matzi, blessing of the challah, the host poses a question for us to consider. It could be a question based on the Torah reading for the week, a life event that one of us has recently experienced, or the news of the day. Since this particular Shabbat was also the fourth night of Hanukkah, I decided to offer a question based on one of the major themes of the holiday, rededication. Hanukkah means dedication, as the holiday marks the rededication of the Second Temple in Jerusalem after the Maccabees liberated it. Legend has it that when the temple was liberated, only a single krus of pure olive oil suitable for lighting the temple menorah was found, enough to burn for one night. Miracle of miracles, the oil burned for 8 crazy nights. So, as the 9 of us stood crowded around the festive dining room table, the menorah's brightly colored candles ready to be lit, to be followed by the white Shabbat candles, I asked, have you ever had an experience of rededicating yourself to something deeply meaningful to you? Alan, a family physician, talked about his new home workshop, a space, though not yet completed and dedicated, where he could connect to his late father, a Holocaust survivor who had been a builder in Detroit. Sonia, UNC Asheville's director of sustainability, talked about winter, trees breathing in and out, and a water filter on her kitchen sink that, as it limits the flow of water in her Nalgene bottle, gives her an opportunity to slow down and collect or rededicate herself. Deborah, the recently retired director of the University Center for Diversity Education, spoke of the nurturing experience of Friday night gatherings with close friends. It's like being with mother, she said, referring to her late mother. I spoke of immersing myself in the ocean as a mikveh, a Jewish ritual bath, a restorative act, a moment to experience the simple, profound wonder of the human body and spirit, a kind of rededication of the temple of human life. As we shared experiences around the table, preparing to light the physical candles, we glowed, the nine of us, a little more brightly. And for the first time in many years, Hanukkah was spiritually alive for me. We blessed the candles, the wine, the bread. Lori's latkes, topped with her homemade applesauce, had never tasted better. And for dessert, Sonia made... Okay, here we go. Sufganiyot, and I apologize for that and all the other words I may have mispronounced. Hebrew for jelly donuts, another symbolic Hanukkah treat. Together, we were remembering, reconnecting, rededicating ourselves to friends and family, living and dead. Sonia's Sufganiyot reminded me of when I lived in Israel in the late 1970s, which is when I first ate them. Those were the years when I, as a young adult, began finding a home in Jewish life, and when Jewish life began building its home in me. Until then, I had been a typical assimilated middle-class American Jewish boy growing up in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. My first trip back to Israel with Lori and our kids was many years later. 14 years since that last visit, our passion for Israel seemed to have dwindled. As much as the intensity of my connection to Israel had diminished, that was nothing compared to how I felt about the Second Temple, liberated and rededicated centuries ago by the Maccabees. The temple had become for me nothing more than a metaphor. Much like latkes, crisped in canola oil, not olive oil, were just a symbol thousands of years later, and in Asheville, more than 6,000 miles from Jerusalem. What a surprise, then, to find myself 6 months later on a tour bus with 40 other Ashevillians, cruising past Modin, the famed city where the Maccabean Rebellion began. It was the last day of a 12-day summer trip to Israel, and we passed the modern, even futuristic-looking, planned city of Modin. I caught a glimpse of it out of the bus window, and I felt it. Hanukkah in July. The land of Israel, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Golan Heights overlooking Syria to the Negev Desert, the cities young old young, the people, immigrants and descendants of immigrants from all over, the history and the language, Hebrew, our language, the language of prayer and Torah, and which I have had uninterrupted engagement through the years, the spoken language with which I have had very little engagement for far too many years, the music, the poetry, gathered, concentrated in one place, home. On that bus I saw it, and I felt it, and I knew I'd rededicated myself to Israel. I may not live there physically, but my life has more life to it when I'm there. The richness of the experience will fade. The intimacy of our Hanukkah sharing, the liveliness of Israel, which for Lori and me feels like home, at least as much as our physical home in North Carolina. Lucky for us, Hanukkah will come around again, a time to rededicate ourselves to the people, places, and ways of living that mean the most to us here and there. The author, Richard Chess, is an essayist, poet, and professor of Jewish studies at UNC Asheville. And I don't think we'll have time to finish this article entirely, but first let me remind you that you are listening to Our State Magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and if you have any comments on our program, please call studios 919-832-5133. I had a little chuckle because somebody probably wants to correct a few of the words I spoke in the last article. Luck by the slice. In Forsyth County's Greek community, a traditional New Year's Day cake is a reminder that family is the source of good fortune. Written by Victoria bulubasus. For 3 years, I kept a crusty aluminum foil-wrapped quarter in my wallet. I often forgot it was there, wedged between crumpled receipts and credit cards, but it was my lucky coin, a talisman I carried to remind me of my Greek roots. I had plucked it from a Greek cake called Vassalopita that's made to celebrate and honor the hope that comes with each new year. The idea is similar to a king cake, but instead of a tiny plastic baby buried inside, the surprise is a foil-wrapped coin. A quarter, usually. A half dollar if you're extra lucky. Dusted in powdered sugar and decorated with the new year shaped in gleaming white Jordan almonds or sesame seeds, Vassalopita appears on Greek kitchen tables on New Year's Day. Recipes vary by region, but my family's version, which is common in Greek-American communities, has a coffee cake texture with hints of orange and lemon zest. Tempting as it may be to dig in right away, everyone must wait for the family to gather first. The ritual in how we cut our Vassalopita is rooted in the idea of earning extra blessings in the Greek Orthodox tradition. In my family, we start with the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Each figure gets a slice in that order. As a kid, I always hoped the coin would not be stuck in one of the holy slices. It would be too unfair. Not that I ever admitted as much out loud. Indeed, I waited and waited as the cutting continued from the eldest in the family, including whoever might be present at the table, to the youngest. I knew how easy it would be to cheat at this game. A foil-wrapped coin dropped in batter sinks to the depths of a spring-form pan. Whoever releases the cake from its metal harness to cool in the rack, always my mother, will likely see the foil settled on the bottom. But I grew up with enough superstition that I never looked. I didn't want to jinx it. And all these years later, the tradition remains the only lesson in patience that stuck with me from childhood. When it was finally my turn for a slice, I remember wishing, hoping for the knife to clack into the coin. The coin in your slice meant a whole year's worth of good luck, a gift worth far more than the coin itself. As the daughter of a Greek immigrant who blessed me with the name Victoria Vassalika Bulubasis, quite a mouthful in my hometown of Clemens, and here at the reading service, I was always happy to have a little extra luck. For many first or second generation immigrants in the United States, our cultural traditions are mirrors. But like old mirrors passed down through generations, they offer reflections through smudged glass and rusted edges. Modern interpretations get a little distorted. We see what we'd like to see, and it's not always clear. Take Vassalopita. The cake is named after Saint Basil, our version of Santa, a legendary character traditionally bearing gifts on New Year's Day, though often westernized as Christmas Day. To me, he always seemed more like a Greek Robin Hood, or even a socialist saint, because I was taught that he took from the rich and gave to the poor by slyly baking coins and treasures into cakes. My cousin, Anna Prokos, who lives in Waxhaw, wrote a children's book called The Lucky Cake after realizing that her own four Greek children didn't really know what they'd been celebrating all these years. Anna called her grandmother to get questions, or rather answers to her questions, about St. Basil. But the quest proved futile. After I hung up with her, Anna told me lately, it sank in that Greek Orthodox all over the world have this tradition, and no one knows why. My attachment to Vassalopita is more personal than any legend. January 1 is my name day, which in Greek tradition is a kind of second birthday. I'm named after my paternal grandmother. When I was born an ocean away in the U.S., she requested that my parents name me Vasiliki, roughly translated as royal. Vasilikis are also called Vicky in Greece, which turns out to be particularly important when we moved from our ethnically diverse New Jersey neighborhood to Clemens, a town classified as a village in official documents. My first day of third grade in North Carolina began with a teacher taking attendance, Victoria Vasiliki. I wanted to hide. My fellow students at Southwest Elementary School fondly christened me Vaseline Bubblicious. I didn't realize then that nearby Winston-Salem had a long history of Greek kids growing up similarly embarrassed. Even before there was a permanent Greek Orthodox church in town, there was a Greek school so that immigrant children wouldn't lose the literacy of their native tongue or their cultural traditions. I grew up going to that Greek school and attending Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church, where we learned Kalanda, New Year's Day caroling. Chaperones drove us to different homes in the Greek community, where we'd often be welcomed inside with Vasilipita. Rita M. Georgiulis and her sister-in-law, Virginia G. Mutus and Betsy G. Vlahos, who are now in their 70s, are mainstays in our community. They grew up in the first Greek community in Winston-Salem. Sitting in my mother's living room, they swapped memories of teenage crushes from those early days. "We all took turns having a crush on Pete," Rita says. "He was cute," chimes in Virginia. "He was Greek," offers Betsy, Virginia's sister. "But he wasn't Greek," Virginia deadpans. Rita, Virginia, and Betsy, who's also a Vasiliki, navigated a first-generation upbringing together, trying to fit into American ways, all the while being pulled by their roots and their parents to stay Greek. Rita arrived at 7 years old. She started the first grade in Winston-Salem and remained, she says, a spunky, talkative kid, though through high school. "We were American from 8:30 until 3 o'clock, she says. After that, we were Greek. It's been almost 70 years since Hercules Amprasis, my papu grandfather, boarded a ship off the coast of Athens for a new life in America. He was escaping a gruesome civil war that took a heavy toll on his village. His father presumably died in battle in the mountains of Evrytania, where they lived. The messenger who came to my great-grandmother's house to deliver the news of her husband's death found her already weeping at the doorstep, covered head to toe in black mourning clothes. She had just buried her youngest son, who stepped on a landmine while tending to the family's cows a few yards from the home. And that, I'm afraid, is all the time we're going to have for today's edition of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios 919-832-5138. So long until next time.